Yeah. Like, I'll look at it later.
Yeah.
No way to.
No, it's over.
Okay.
I'm gonna be wrong.
Yeah, no, I'm wrong. Yeah. So after that.
Are you like, it's over?
Honestly,
it's not enough food. It's not enough food.
I never.
Did you come with a list for this thing?
Was it fresh?
No.
On Tuesday, I didn't come.
Oh, okay.
Was it useful?
Sure. Yeah, I'm lost.
Okay, let's start. Today we will finish talking about pipelining and hopefully start the basics of caching. So far we have talked about how we can use forwarding in our pipelines. We also talked about how we can use prediction or branches to avoid some of the stalls. So after we have done all the logic for forwarding and predictions, where do we still need to stall? So there are actually two cases. First is if we need memory output in the fetch stage, that would lead to some stall, and one example is return. So for return, we resolve the address that we want to fetch the next instruction in the memory stage. So whatever the output we have from memory, we need in the fetch that introduces some stalls in the pipeline. And also it could happen that we have memory output which we need in the execute stage. Example would be if we are doing MR move queue, so memory to register. So after we have read something from memory, then there is some consecutive instruction that's trying to use that value. So the output is generated in the memory stage, but we may want to use it in the execute stage. So if this is how the full pipeline looks as it we have seen so far. So we have five stages, and most of the time we are supposed to complete one instruction per cycle. So that should be our common case, but then there are all these exceptions when we have hazards. If we have data hazard, we solved it using forwarding, and we are assuming that that will resolve some of the stalls we have for data hazard. Then we could have load to use hazard. That leads to one cycle stalling because we need to generate the output and use it in the execute. We talked about branch prediction, which we could use to resolve this jump control hazard. So if we, once we have determined what should be our next fetch address, which is at the execute stage, then we have to squash all the instructions that we have already fetched and fetch the correct address if we have mispredicted. That would lead to two cycles of penalty. But if we actually take the branch, then the benefit is we don't have to squash anything, and also we have not inserted any bubbles in our pipeline. So using branch prediction and squashing, that kind of resolve the control hazard unless we have mispredicted. And then we have these return control hazard where the we read the memory for our fetch address, and that we will use in our for the next instruction fetch state. So that means that we need to stall for 3 cycles after the memory stage, and we need to insert some bubbles there. So one design choice regarding this return is could we just forward the output of memory that we have here directly to our predicted PC without going through the register. I guess let's first explain what's the figure we are seeing here. So this is the full pipeline. This is the fetch stage, decode, execute, memory, and this is the register for write back. And in the for return, we will get our address after we have read the memory in the memory stage, and that will go to this write back pipeline register. And in the next cycle, during the write back stage, we read that value from our pipeline register, and then it goes to this mux where it is an input to our instruction memory. And there is another option. You could have just said that why we actually have to write it back to our this pipeline register for the write back stage. We could have just avoided it. We could have just said that after I have read my next fetch address, I will just forward it directly to our fetch stage and make it an input to our instruction memory. So in that case, we bypass this write back stage and directly move to this here, move the value to our fetch stage. And this is a perfectly valid design choice, so there is nothing incorrect here. But this is not something we do because there are some other issues. And can anyone tell me what could be the problem if we decide to use this design? So we would just take the value of the output from memory, the return address, and instead of going through the pipeline registers, we will directly make it an input to our fetch state. So there is nothing incorrect here. It is correct. But there is a reason that we don't do it. Anyone? So it is actually a slightly trickier matter. So it is related to the critical path we have in our pipeline. So if we have decided to use this path, use this design choice that we would just avoid the write back register and take a direct path, this is how the critical path would look like, which is mainly what is the longest path we need to traverse in order to go through all the pipeline stages. And with this design, we actually, what do we have to do? We have to read memory and get our return address. Then the address would pass along through a where. It will come here as an input to our instruction memory. Then we will read the instruction memory. That will output our address, the PC that we want, and that will come to our PC register. So this would be the path that we actually have to traverse within one cycle. And that kind of makes the cycle longer because there are two memory access within one cycle. We have to access the data memory, we also have to access instruction memory, and memories are usually slower. So if we have to use, if we have to have two memory accesses within one cycle, that means that we need more time, that just increases our cycle length. And in the pipelining, the reason we have pipelining so that we can reduce the length of each cycle. That is what giving us more throughput. So that's why we don't usually make the cycles too long. If we didn't care about how long the cycle is, we could have just used the single cycle processor instead of going through all this trouble for pipelining. Any question here? Is it clear? So essentially, we want a balanced pipeline where all the stages take almost the same amount of time, so that we don't one stage doesn't become the bottleneck. So that's the goal of pipelining. We want to make the cycles as short as possible, but it's okay to maybe have more of them, because at the end, most of the time, we will have one instruction completing every cycle. So that is what we are trying to do with all these forwarding and prediction. Any question? Okay. So the other thing we were talking about is what happens if we have these we have some output from memory at the memory stage, which is then needed by some instruction in its execute stage. So here, MR move Q, it produces some value, and with the sub Q uses that. So in that case, we actually have to insert some bubble in our pipeline and stall the pipeline so that we can forward that output of memory to the execute stage. So this is very common design choice that we make in our modern processor, but I guess in our textbook, this is not how it's done. But we are just showing that this is a completely valid choice. We can do it. It is possible to take the output of memory and forward it. Okay. So this is for this one. And then there is another case where it is possible that there is a memory to register move queue. So we have some output at the memory stage, and that is required by some other memory instruction, which will write it back to memory. So for example, MR move Q followed by register to memory move Q. So this is also a very, it is an acceptable choice that once we have read it in the memory stage, we can forward it to the next memory stage instead of waiting till it gets to the, we write it back in the register file and read it back in the decode stage. So this is a form of forwarding that is valid and it's done in most of the processor, but in our textbook it is not done this way, but this is a valid choice. And you can do it in other assignments, right?
We are careful to not test the number of cycles you take to do this. So you can implement this or do what our textbook does and not implement it.
So it's up to you.
Yeah.
So now we will move to how we would insert bubble or stall if we actually have to do them for some reason in our pipeline. And if you think about it, what is stall? Stall is we just don't want to use the new values, but we just want to keep using whatever the same value we have in our pipeline, that is stall. Or we could also insert bubble, where it means that we are supposed to insert some default values instead of using the new values. So for the decision if we want to stall or not, we could use it, we could implement it using a mux before our this before this PC register, and have a input which says that, okay, if we want to stall, please just you don't use the new values, keep the whatever value we have right now in the stage. That's a valid design choice. We could, if you all know how to use mux, we could do that. Also for bubble, it's mainly in what we, the decision we need to make is we actually either have to use our default value, or if it's a bubble, and if it's not a bubble, if it's a normal operation of our stage, then we are supposed to use our regular register values that we will get from our pipeline register. So that is also we can implement using a mux, which says if it's do something, if it's a bubble, do something else, if it's not. And that will require you to implement this logic every place in the pipeline, in our pipeline. But actually, there is an easier way we have, we are using in our assignments, where we have this signal called stall B and bubble B, which goes to every place in our pipeline. And the only thing you need to know, you need to do is set the values for these signals properly at each stage, or wherever you have to implement a bubble or a stall. So for stall, what you have to set is you want to keep the old value for all register, so that the whatever register input goes to the output. So you don't want to use the normal operation. For bubble, you actually want to insert some new values, but that's the default value. So this is not the regular value that you're using in the pipeline stages. And we actually have to implement this logic depending on when we want to insert a bubble or when we want to stall. So first thing, before we see how we do that, let's try to be clear about what the bubble does and what the stall does to the pipeline and the register. So here, it means that the input is A, the output is B, and the default value is FF in hexadecimal. And this is an assignment where we are trying to see that what happens to our inputs and outputs when we decide if we want to stall or bubble, or we want to go on with the normal operations. And this is the time. So at time zero, our input was 01, and the output is the default value that I guess we set it in the beginning, initial like this. And then we have two signals. Stall B and bubble B. If one of them is set, we actually have to do something based on that signal. So try to think about what would be the output values. If these are our inputs, and you can see sometimes the stall signal is raised, sometimes the bubble, sometimes we will just go on with the regular operation. So you can discuss with your, discuss with others, try to think about what are the values that B would have. And the hint is for stall, we want to keep the old value. For bubble, we want to store the default value. Like the reason we are doing this exercise is because most of the time we kind of confuse that when the effect of the bubble or the stall will take on. So if we at cycle time zero, we are supposed to have the regular operation, the normal operation. And that is why the 0-1 would get to the output at the next cycle, because it is supposed to be the none of the stall or bubble cycle is turned on. That means that it's supposed to do whatever regular operation should happen. So the stall signal is turned on at cycle 1, which means that it's supposed to stall the pipeline in the next cycle. So that's why at cycle 2, the value remains the same. Because for stall, we say that keep whatever the output is, keep it as it is. So we are supposed to take the output and just make it as an input. Then here, at cycle 3, we say that insert a bubble. So that's why it takes effect in the next cycle and the output becomes the default value FA. The next two cycles, they are regular operation, so I guess that's why nothing happens here. And then we have two stalls, so we keep the value the same in the next cycles. So this is a major confusion people have when they're doing their assignments. So that's why we are being more careful and trying to make sure that it's clear to you. So now let's do another exercise just to make sure that we are very clear about what happens with stalls and bubbles. So here we have our pipeline stages, and for each pipeline stage, suppose there is some value like E, D, C, B, A. And in cycle two, you can see that either we keep the value or there is the default value or there is something else happening. And we want to decide what is causing that. Like, is that a stall, is that a bubble, or is that the normal operation, which says is the new value. So again, write down your answers and then let's compare. And the hint is here. If we are keeping the old value at the next cycle, that means it's a stall. If we are using the default value in the next cycle, that means it's a bubble. And for normal operation, it's just supposed to flow in the next cycle. The answers. So you can see that in the next cycle, we didn't move E in the next stage. So that means that and use the knob there, the default value. And that only happens if we insert a bubble. Then here, we are keeping C and C. It didn't move to the next stage of execute. So that means that it is a stall. And here, we inserted a knob in the memory stage at cycle two. That only happens if we insert a bubble. And the B from the memory stage, it moved to our write back stage. So that's the normal operation that we are doing. Yes.
Initially, more wipes from D to C is stalled.
D to C. So here, in the execute stage, okay, if it was a regular operation, what would have happened? The D was in decode stage. In the next cycle, it is supposed to be in the execute stage, right? But that didn't happen. What happened is we just kept whatever value we already had in the execute stage, and it is still in the execute stage. So that will only happen when we say it at the decode stage that insert is stalled. So that's why instead of D moving from decode to execute, we keep the value C. The C remains there. And also for the first one, I guess, if we are fetching a new instruction, that would have meant that instead of E, there would have been something else. And in the regular operation, E should have moved to our decode stage in the next cycle. But that didn't happen. We actually made E stay the same, and we didn't fetch anything new, and also we inserted a bubble so that here we have this default value now. Any more questions? Okay. I guess you already asked. So this is another example, but I think this is just to, it's the similar thing we are trying to do, so I will just go through it. So here we actually, for the regular operation, you can see that the E actually moved to the next decode stage. The D didn't move to, from decode, it didn't move to execute stage, and we keep the value both C, so that is a stall. C didn't move to from execute to memory. Instead, we insert a bubble, so that's a bubble. And B, from memory, it moves to write back, so that's a regular operation. So this is, again, just to make sure that in your mind it's clear when we are inserting bubble and when we are inserting a stall signal. So let's try to see that how it affects our pipeline, especially the return instruction. So suppose here we have a call instruction, which is followed by a return. And we know that for return, we actually have to resolve the address in the memory memory stage, and only then we could start fetching the next instruction. So there we actually have to insert stall and bubbles depending on what we want to do. So that's what we will learn now. So first, when return is at the fetch stage, it goes to the next cycle. At cycle two, it goes to our decode. And then we actually we can't do anything because we're still waiting for the address. So that means that here, we actually have to insert a stall. At cycle three, the return moves from decode to execute. That means that now we actually have to insert a stall for fetch, but also for the decode, we don't have anything to do yet. So that means that we have to insert a no-op instruction. We have to insert a bubble. Then it's similar. The return moves to our moves to the memory stage, and now you have three things to do. So first, we actually have to stall the decode because we are still waiting for return. Then in the decode, we don't have we are not supposed to do anything, so there we have to insert a bubble. But the third one, like here, we actually don't have, like we are not supposed to do anything, but you don't have to explicitly insert a bubble, because the bubble would, like the way pipelining works, if it's a bubble, it will just move with each stage at each cycle. So that's, I guess, it's just taken care of by the way we have designed our pipeline. And then at the memory stage, the return decides what's the output of memory, and that is when we can fetch our next instruction. So at that time, for the fetch stage, we will do the normal operation, but we still don't have anything to do at the decode, so there is a bubble there. So when you're trying to implement this, that means that you actually, depending on where return is in the pipeline, you actually have to insert either stall or bubble. And what's the way we could implement it? We could just have a counter which says that if it's one cycle after return, there is a stall in the fetch. If it's two cycles, then do something else, insert a stall or bubble. If it's three cycles, do something. That is a valid way to implement it. But you can see that, like, what is the information we are trying to refer? The information is, where is the return in our pipeline, in which stage it is in. And depending on that, we can decide what, where to insert bubble or where to insert the stall. So that is what actually we will use instead of using a counter. So if the return is in my decode stage, that means that I have to insert a stall in fetch and a bubble in decode for my next cycle. So if you want to see how it should be implemented in our HCL, this is how it would look like. So there is this need return bubble, which we have to set appropriately. And for this one, we are just showing it for return. So when do we need to insert a bubble? We need to insert a bubble when the return is in decode. So that's why, so there's DI code. If the I code in decode matches to return, we are supposed to insert a bubble. If the I code in decode and I code in memory is return, we are supposed to insert a bubble. So this is how we would implement it in HCL. And then there is this bubble D signal that goes to everywhere, right? So that's what we would say, that if any of this is true, then we need to insert this bubble signal. And you actually have to implement the other cases. Like, this is just for return. And I guess also how to fetch the address. I guess that's a different thing. Any question here, at least related to the bubble and stalls? Okay. So The other instance where we are supposed to insert some bubbles is actually when we have to squash things after a misprediction. So for branches, we are always taking the branch, but there would be some cases where the prediction is wrong, and we have to, whatever we have fetched in our pipeline, we have to squash it. So here, let's assume that we have these jump not equal to instructions, and we speculatively start fetching more instructions. The ones that have a question mark, these are the ones we are not sure, but we are just speculatively starting to fetch and decode them. And when the jump is at execute, this is where we actually resolve the jump address. And depending on that, if we have mispredicted, then we fetch the correct one, and we actually have to make all of these go away. So basically, once we have resolved the address, now we actually have to make sure that whatever we had in the execute and decode, that is, we squash it and insert a bubble there. And for the fetch stage, we actually have to fetch the new instruction. So in terms of bubble, stall, and normal operation, you can see that here, The fetch stage is doing the normal operation, but for the decode and execute, we are inserting bubble here. So that is how you will implement the squashing in the pipelines. Any question here? Okay. I guess let's see the HCL code. So here, it's the logic is very similar. So we will look at where the jump instruction is in our pipeline state. So if it is in execute state, so the I code matches to jump, and also if we find out that our prediction is wrong, the branch is not taken, then we actually have to insert a bubble in the decode and execute. So that is what we are doing. Like we detected misprediction if the I code in execute is jump and the branch is not taken. And based on this, we are turning on the signal for bubble at decode and execute. Any question here? So after we have seen forwarding prediction, how to use or insert bubbles and stalls, there are still some missing pieces that we haven't covered actually. So these are kind of more advanced things which you don't have to implement, but these are the things that are used in modern processor. So it's good to know what's happening there. So there are two things we'll talk about, multi-cycle memory, and beyond pipelining, what is happening in current processor. So the first thing, multi-cycle memory, in our pipeline, we just assume that it takes one cycle to read or write memory. And this is mostly true, but because we are using caching, which is a form of memory, but it's not the memory that you plug in your system. So that's basically a cache, which we will cover, like start covering from this class or next class. So the behavior of caches is it will give us memory access within with one cycle, but sometimes it will actually miss and we have to go to the original memory, which is much, much slower than the cache. So the caching gives us a mechanism that most of the time we will get the data in one cycle. So that's the typical average case. But sometimes it will just take many, many cycles. So the pipeline is supposed to handle all those things. But the way it is done is very similar to just using these stalls and bubbles. So for the first case, if we have found our data in our cache, which just takes one cycle, then the pipeline looks the same as we have seen so far. You can do forwarding, prediction, and things are very similar to what we have done so far. But if it's a cache miss, that means that the memory access, which was taking one cycle, now it just takes many more cycles. Let's assume for this example, it takes five cycles. And that just means that any instruction that was coming after that now have to stall. So that's why you can see that in the execute stage, the next instruction cannot just move forward. It's just stalling, and once we get the value from memory and that conflict is resolved, only then that our pipeline can move forward. So similar here, if there is another memory access where we don't have the data in the cache, that will just stall the pipeline. So you can think about it, it's kind of the regular pipeline, but sometimes the stalling is just way too long when we have a cache miss. The other things that we have in the pipeline, one of them is we will talk about is out, I guess the first we will talk about the multiple issue. So in the current pipeline that you have seen, what do? We fetch one instruction every cycle. But in modern processors, what happens is they have a wider pipeline. So they can fetch multiple instructions per cycle. For example, many of the processors nowadays fetch 2 to 4 instructions per cycle. And that means that it is kind of the same pipeline that you have seen, but instead of one thing happening at one cycle, there are actually multiple instructions happening at the same time. So for this example, it's a 2-wide pipeline, so we can fetch 2 instructions per cycle. So that's why at cycle 0 we have 2, at cycle 1 then we are fetching 2 more. So it's just increasing the throughput by 2. And I guess if you think about it, the benefit is now we have 2 instructions coming out of our pipeline instead of 1, so that's better performance. But in terms of implementation, what do you need? Like now you actually need to have two instruction memory, 2 data memory, maybe 2 ALUs. So everything in your pipeline needs to be doubled. And also you have to have the logic to decide what instruction you are fetching. So there is some extra complexity there. So it's multiple parallel pipeline, and I said that we need more resource for that. And for ALU, maybe we just duplicate it. For register files, what we could do is we could add multiple ports where we could read or write 2 things at the same time. Or I guess if it's, we keep our same pipeline, 4. Any question here? Yes. So this is what we have seen so far. And I guess that's the next thing we will see. So that's a lot of penalty, like penalty we are paying if we have a cache miss. So this is not how we many of the processors, the fast processors, do nowadays. So people have figured out that, okay, we are losing a lot of performance if we have just to stall if there is one cache miss, right? So what we do now, like now in the processors, is we try to find independent instruction which doesn't depend on that cache miss. So for example here, suppose we have a stall for this MR move queue. And this MR move queue is followed by the subtraction, which depends, there is a data dependency. So if we keep the pipeline that we have seen so far, which is in order, that will mean that this add and XOR or whatever instruction that is coming after that, all of them are getting stalled, even if they actually don't have any true dependency on this memory instruction. What we do instead is we try to figure out which one are independent, and if they don't have any conflict with the ones that is still happening, we let them start executing. So that's why you could see that the dependent instruction, the subtraction, that is still stalling, but the independent ones, they could go through the pipeline. So this obviously gives us better performance, but now you can think about what's the complexity. The complexity is we need to track which one is dependent on the instructions that we have. And as I said, we have a wider pipeline, right? So if it's a four wide pipeline, four instructions coming every cycle, you have to, whatever instruction you are the following, you need to keep track of all dependencies. That requires more logic. Also, then you have to figure out the independent ones and start executing them. So it becomes more complex. And think about the forwarding, I guess. Forwarding and squashing. Like if you start executing all these, now you detect you actually mispredicted. You have to figure out which are the dependent ones, squash them. So essentially, it's just more logic to figure out all those things. But the basic idea is if we know some instruction is not dependent on the ones which is stalling the pipeline, we will just let them run. Any question? Okay. So some of other things that we do in modern processor is related to branch prediction. So the branch prediction that we have seen our pipeline, it's very simple. We say that we will just assume that the branch is always taken. But there could be more sophisticated branch prediction. And the ones that we use nowadays are very, very complex, but there is one which is very simple, but it actually provides a very good performance, which is if the target is greater than the PC. So if it's a forward branch, usually it's not taken. And if it's a backward branch, usually it's taken. So why this makes sense? Look at the loops. So this is our loop, and here is our jump. And usually, we iterate through the loops multiple times. So that means that the backward branch is mostly taken. And when we are getting out of the loop, that's the forward branch. And usually, that's taken just once. And when you're exiting the loop. So even this simple technique or simple intuition that forward not taken, backward taken provides a better performance. But then there is this complexity that you have to track if your target is higher or lower, and based on that, you need to do something. Any question? Related to branch prediction, we didn't talk about return address prediction. So the highest stall in the pipeline that we have now is based on return. So we actually have to stall until we get the return address in the memory stage, and only then we start fetching the next instruction. So in modern processors, there is a predictor to predict what is our return address and speculatively start fetching some instructions. And the way it works is it actually have a small amount of registers which keeps the return addresses in the processor. So in the stack that we have in our programs, that is actually in memory, and it has many things, like we keep our local variables there, we keep our return address, it serves multi-purpose, and also it's in memory. But for prediction, what we do is we keep only the return address, and because it's in the processor, we can't just keep all of them. So it's kind of a limited storage where we could limited number of registers, where we can store some of them. And if we ran out of space, we have to kick something out. So that's why it's a prediction. So sometimes we will know what might be the next return address, and sometimes we may not have it. But branch prediction is actually quite important in the modern processors, because that's what is giving us to reduce a lot of bubbles which is caused by jumps. So I guess there are multiple ways the prediction can happen. We have seen some simpler ones, but the real ones, they are kind of complex. They try to keep a history of previous branches, use a table to locate what was the prior jump address, was it taken or not. So essentially, a significant amount of resource in the processor goes to branch prediction. So there are tables in the processor. So remember, it's not in memory. So it is within the processor, and we don't actually have that much resource in the processor to store all of those. But even then, because branch prediction is so important, we spend a significant amount of resource in processor for prediction. So here, this is like a old die photo of a CPU from 2004. And you can, it shows that where the different units in our pipeline is located in the die. So you could see floating point, unit, load store, memory controller, the front end, which is fetch, decode. But I guess the main thing that comes across this die photo is most of the space is cache. We will start talking about the cache in a few moments. But the thing we want to show here is, even for branch prediction, because it uses larger tables and keeps track of branch histories, actually you can see that there is a significant amount of resource it's used for branch prediction. It's kind of like maybe 1/4 of the data cache. And I guess you could see this is the approximate space we think the registers are, but the cache is actually very easy to locate because they look very different from the logic. And again, this is an old photo. You can try to look up the new ones and see where are the caches, where are the other units. So in today's processors, I guess we have seen it has pipelining, it has multiple wide pipeline, maybe it has branch prediction. So one thing you could think about is, what's the trade-off between having more pipeline stage and the benefit of having this pipeline. So if we have more pipeline stages, we can make the cycle time shorter, and that means that we are getting more instructions, so the throughput of the instruction is getting higher. So that's the advantage of having a deeper pipeline. But then we need to think about, there are all these complexities and overhead when we have to squash the pipeline or insert the bubble. So if it's a deeper pipeline, so the one we have seen is 5 stage, maybe there are 20 stages. That means that you actually have to squash many more things if you mispredicted something, or there is a stall for cache, there you just have to stall for more time. So that's why when we had this pipelining, the vendors, they wanted more and more pipeline and tried to make the clock frequency higher. So the more pipelines you have, you make the duration of each cycle shorter, that means the frequency is higher. And it was expected that it will give us better performance. So for Pentium 4, which came out around 2000, so it had like 2 to 3x pipeline stages. So it has way deep pipeline, and that what given them the opportunity to make the frequency very high. And it was expected that it will be a highly competitive processor which will beat all the other processors which are not operating at that high frequency. But apparently what happened is when people benchmarked the processor and compared it with other processors at that time, they figure out that just increasing the frequency or adding more pipeline stages didn't make it as competitive. Actually, it was slower than many other processors at that time, which didn't have this high clock rate. So that's why essentially there was a trade-off. Like, we could increase the pipeline to get more throughput, but then all this penalty that we have to pay for data hazard and misprediction, that also needs to be very optimized to make that work. So at the end, nowadays we don't actually increase the frequency that often. The frequency of processors has been around 3 gigahertz, 4 gigahertz for a while. So that's the reason. But also, I guess people are trying to come up with better branch prediction, but that's just hard. Any question here? So this is the same die photo, but instead of branch prediction, let's try to look at the storage components. So register is the one which is the fastest, but also it's very expensive, so we can't have only small amount of them. So if this is our die, you can see that we allocate only small amount of space for our registers because they're just expensive. But at the same time, they're really fast. Then in the next level, we have this L1 cache. So that's the one we have called it memory in our pipeline, but that's basically our cache. And we have these instruction cache here, and we have our data cache, which again you can see it's the amount of resource we are using for it is kind of significant. But then we have the second level of cache, which is almost half of the die. And again, this is an older CPU which didn't have L3 cache, but even in the recent processors, most of them have L2 cache. And if you look at the die photo, you will see that like more than half of the die is allocated for L2. And in the next level, we have our main memory, which is DRAM, which has much larger capacity, but then it's the slowest one. So if you can think about is a memory hierarchy, where at the top, the registers are the fastest, then we have multiple levels of cache. Each level have higher capacity, but it also has higher latency. And at the bottom, we have the memory, which is the cheapest. It has the highest capacity, but also it's the slowest one. And if you look at the latency, registers, because we want to access them each cycle, their latency is less than a nanosecond. L1, usually we want to access them in one cycle, sometimes it's two or three, but it is around one nanosecond. But then you can see it progresses very frequent. The jump is pretty sharp. Like L2, L3, and main memory, if you want to fetch something from memory, it takes around hundreds of nanoseconds. or I guess 100 and something, maybe, like most probably not more than 200. So you can see that like the other than register and memory, we have these caches which is constituting a large fraction of our memory hierarchy. So that's why we will actually take a deeper look at how this works, because that's the one which will provide us the benefit in our pipeline. So if we have to go to memory, the pipeline will get stalled for 100 nanoseconds. But if I can hit, if I find my block or data in the cache, we can resolve it just in 1 nanosecond. So it's a major bottleneck in our pipeline that we have to make sure our caches are efficient. So that's why we will spend significant time about learning them. So what is a cache? It's similar to, like, the interface is very similar to what we call memory. It stores data. If we can address it using some address pins. If we encode an address, we are supposed to get the value within the memory at that address, and that's our output. So at the high level, it's kind of the same. And we can read or write it. We have signals for ready, write it, abort, etc. And even the L2 and L3, they are kind of very similar. But the main difference with memory is cache is really small compared to our memory. So cache can hold a small subset of things that we have in our memory. And when CPU asks the cache to give it some data, it provides an address. So for example, CPU says that give me the data which is located at address ABC. And it could happen that the cache has that value. And in that case, the operation is very similar to memory. It gets the value, it reads the value in the cache and returns back. But it will happen that sometime cache doesn't have that data. And what it does is it forwards that request to the lower level. So if there are multiple levels of cache, it will forward that request to lower level of cache. But let's assume we just have two levels. We have cache and memory. Then that request will get forwarded to memory. And definitely memory has all the things we need. So it will return that value. So for example, let's assume the value at address ABCD is 1000. So DRAM sends that value to cache. Cache stores that for future references. And then the cache returns that value to the CPU. So the key here is the cache will provide us benefit as long as we make sure that most of the things we want is here and the cache doesn't have to get data from memory. And so how we make sure of that? I guess that's the question. Like if the memory is gigabytes and our cache is just maybe 32 kilobytes, it's hard to make sure that whatever you want is in the cache when you can access the whole memory. So the ideal thing we want is we want most of the things we are using in our programs in the cache. So we want a very high hit rate. And also we want to make sure that even if we are accessing things from the whole memory, it's kind of gives an illusion that we have space for all of it, though we may not. So that's kind of a conflicting goal. We have a smaller cache, but somehow we want to give an illusion that it can hold all the things that we are accessing in our program. But as I said, that caches are actually very effective in doing that. And how is that doing? It's a property that most of the programs have that cache is exploiting. and it's called locality of values. There are two kinds of localities. Most of the time when we are accessing something in our program, we have found out that we access them multiple times very frequently. So that's the locality, temporal locality. If something is accessed in the cache now, it is mostly likely that we will access it multiple times in the near future. Also, the values that we use in our programs, they have spatial locality. What is that? Spatial locality says that if we access some value now, it is most likely that we will access nearby values in the future. So HSN data values, HSN addresses, it's very likely that we will use it in the near future. And caches tries to exploit that. They try to keep whatever value we have exist now. They want to store all these values in the cache to exploit temporal locality. Also, whatever value we have used right now, it tries to keep all the adjacent values in the cache to make sure that if there is something, some pattern in our program which has this special locality, we can exploit that. So I said that most of the programs have these localities, but let's see an example. So a very natural example is loops. So for example, let's assume we are traversing an array, and we are calculating the sum of all the elements in the array. And we have data, and also we have the instruction. So we want to think about the locality for both of them. So the temporal locality says that if I have accessed something now, most likely I will access it again in the near future. And that's true for the code which is in the loop. The instruction within the loop, we are accessing it at each iteration. So that's the temporal locality. And the spatial locality for the code is the instruction within the code. If I have used I less than length, if I'm executing that instruction, most likely I will go to the next instruction where I'm summing all the values. But it's also, the locality also holds for the data. If I have, I guess the spatial one is the most obvious one. So if I have accessed the array location I, it's most likely that I will use I plus one, I plus two, and so on. So that's the spatial locality. Also, there are some variables which have temporal locality here. For example, total, or I, or length. If I have, since I'm summing up all the values, we are writing the partial sum in the total. So each time we are iterating this loop, we are writing in the total. So if it's in the cache, that means that we have more locality. So the concept of cache works only because we have this locality. And if all the values that we are touching here is in the cache, the program may not just stall and just think that it has access to whole memory, even though it's not true. So it's an illusion we are giving to our programs that we have higher capacity and fast memory, though actually we have a fast memory with lower capacity, backed up with a large capacity memory which where the access latency is really high. Any question here? Okay, so I guess this is what I have today. We will talk about how the cache works in the next class. Thank you. Thank you.